Hello there, welcome to Turkey Book Talk. Thanks for tuning in again. I'm William Armstrong, speaking to you from here in Istanbul. In this podcast, we hear from authors of newly released books on Turkey and the region. Subscribe through iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher, or Acast. Like the Facebook page. Follow the Twitter account at Turkey Book Talk. Check out show notes and other links at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com and rate or review the podcast on whatever platform you listen on. If you haven't already, also consider joining Turkey Book Talk as a member. Membership gives you various extra benefits and content, and it also helps support the podcast. Paying members get access to a range of extra things, including full transcripts in both English and Turkish of every interview published on Turkey Book Talk in PDF form as soon as the episode is published. Members also receive transcripts of the entire Turkey Book Talk archive in English, which so far amounts to over 60 conversations. Most of these transcripts were previously published at the Hurriyet Daily News, but nowadays a Turkey Book Talk membership is the only way to access them. That archive also includes a number of interviews not previously published on the podcast. Members also get access to a special 30% discount on Turkey and Ottoman history books published by IB Taurus. IB Taurus have a terrific archive of titles, and they've made over 200 books from their Turkey Ottoman history series, both academic and general interest, available at cut price, exclusive to Turkey Book Talk members, through a special discount code. A number of IB Taurus authors have appeared on the podcast in the past, and there will be more in the future, so becoming a member is a great way to get more acquainted with their work. If you do become a member, you'll be helping us develop the podcast, and if more people join, we may end up being able to start publishing a new episode every week, up from the current one episode every 2 weeks. To become a member, just pledge a minimum of $3 per episode via Turkey Book Talk's official Patreon account, which you can find via a link at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com or via any of the other Turkey Book Talk pages. At present, we post new episodes every 2 weeks, so the monthly membership price is no more than $6. If we end up becoming able to publish a new episode every week, then that will go up to $12 monthly maximum, which is not a bad deal at all. Of course, if you're feeling particularly generous and you want to pledge more, then everything helps and you'll certainly be more than welcome. But so long as you pledge $3 or above per episode, membership is entirely at your own discretion. Members are only charged when a new episode is published, so there are no prior commitments or strings attached. You'll be free to sign off whenever you want. But now on with our latest episode. In it, we welcome Erin Banko. She's a journalist at the Star Ledger and the author of Pipe Dreams, The Plundering of Iraq's Oil Wealth, which is published by Columbia Global Reports. With the invasion of Iraq in 2003, the Bush administration said Iraq's rich oil reserves would be crucial in rebuilding and democratizing the country. Reality has turned out rather differently. Estimates suggest that oil in Iraq has produced more than $700 billion in revenues since 2003, accounting for about 80% of all the country's funding. But what exactly has happened to Iraq's oil wealth since the US invasion is not widely known. Banko's book is a very sharp investigation of the oil sector in Iraq, particularly in the semi-autonomous Kurdistan Regional Government, or KRG. In it, Banko covers squalid backroom deals, unscrupulous foreign oil companies, rampant corruption among local officials, and she also refers to the crucial, paradoxical role of Turkey in the KRG's oil sector. We had this conversation back at the start of May, shortly before Iraq's general election, and I started by asking Erin Banko what prompted her to embark on this project in the first place.
Sure. I didn't plan on writing a book. I was reporting as a correspondent for Newsweek Media Group, International Business Times in Istanbul. I was a Middle East correspondent based there and was traveling in and out of Iraq, covering ISIS and the rise of ISIS and focusing on the role of oil in that fight. And that's sort of, you know, what piqued my interest in the subject of oil. And, you know, as I continue to develop sources and, you know, continue to report from the ground, I decided that, you know, it was a book that needed to be told. And as I say in my introduction, it's sort of a much larger story than my book alone. This tells just a fraction of the story of oil and Iraq and corruption, but I think it's an important one. And so a lot of my reporting was done on the ground, but a lot of it was also done from places like London and New York, and was told, you know, the story's told through documents as well. So that's sort of how I set out to write the book, but it wasn't my original intention to write a book. It was just sort of my intention to cover the story in Iraq as a correspondent. But then as I learned more and received more information from my sources and, you know, sort of waded through some documents, I decided that it was a book.
And the book is really focused on the KRG, Iraqi Kurdistan, there in the north. But I think more broadly, the kind of idea that the invasion of Iraq in 2003 was motivated, you know, basically entirely by oil is quite widely held inside and outside Iraq. Oil calculations were definitely a major motivating factor, really. But of course, the situation is also a bit more complicated. So I don't know, I was thinking as I was reading the book, it's always kind of striking, really, that, you know, while that whole narrative was going on when the occupation of Iraq was going on, what really has happened to the oil in Iraq is not really that widely known outside the country. I mean, was that something that struck you as you were reporting the book?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't go into writing this book with the idea that we went to war for oil. I mean, I think that idea is obviously one that's held by a lot of people around the world. And I think oil was obviously a motivating factor. But, you know, there are a lot of people who were in the government at that time that say, you know, 9/11 played a bigger part. So I didn't go into writing this book with that idea in mind. What I really wanted to understand was why there was so much oil wealth in the country and why so little of it had been returned back to the land and to the people. And I had studied the resource curse in graduate school and had done a lot of work in Tanzania and looked at Nigeria and sort of had understood how this idea played out in parts of Africa. And I wanted to understand whether it applied to Iraq and specifically to the Kurdish region in the north. And so that was my main goal in approaching this book, was to understand, you know, what happened to the oil wealth and why so little of it, we don't see so much of it, you know, in things like infrastructure projects and hospitals, and why, you know, local people are still struggling to receive their civil servant salaries. So these are all questions that I had in the first few months as I was approaching writing, researching and writing the book.
And the resource curse that you refer to there, just for laymen, it's this kind of idea, this concept that, you know, there's a country or a state that has vast natural resources, but they're kind of siphoned off. The wealth from them doesn't really reach ordinary people. It's pumped and sold, and it goes into the pockets of regimes and politicians and companies, and not really into the pockets of ordinary people.
Right. And, you know, it's this idea that there's an incredible amount of one particular kind of resource, which in this case is oil, in a given area, and that resources, it's sort of exploited by all types of characters, by international oil companies, by different countries, by local politicians. And it sort of, at the basis of it all, it forms this foundation of greed and this vie for power and money. And we've seen this play out across the world. And I think we haven't really looked at, you know, Iraq as a country that has suffered from this resource curse. At least, you know, we haven't really paid attention to how it's developed. And part of the reason is because the country has been through, you know, several wars and has had other things to deal with, you know, humanitarian crises. But I think through all of that, it's important to understand what happened to the money.
Now, the book is focused on the KRG, Iraqi Kurdistan, and there's been this narrative that's kind of built up really since 2003, basically, and actually before then, that this region of Iraq is kind of an island of stability, really, and even democracy, really, in Iraq. And it has indeed sort of avoided a lot of the, you know, violent tumult that has shaken Iraq for years. But as the book shows, there's this kind of eye-watering corruption really going on, and that's a rather simplistic line to take, you know, that the situation is rather more complicated in Iraqi Kurdistan. Could you just kind of talk about this kind of image from the outside and what the reality is?
So I think you're right. I think in general, looking at Iraq, you know, a lot of people, at least from the U.S., view the Kurds as this sort of pillar of stability, that the Peshmerga are warriors, which they are in many ways. But there's this foundation of stability in the region, and that, you know, the Kurds are the ones that we can trust in the country. And you know, they're there to basically turn Iraq around. And I think, you know, there's a lot of people who think that, especially, you know, we hear this from analysts in the U.S. or U.S. ambassadors or politicians. And I think in many ways that is true. After the toppling of Saddam, the Kurds were seen by the U.S. and by many other countries as a group of people that were way more functional than perhaps the government in the south and in Baghdad. And in that way, we saw them, as you said, as, you know, these stabilizing forces. But my book sort of takes a bit of a different view. It looks at the internal dynamics between the major political political parties in the region and the ways in which those rivalries have sort of found themselves in bins of corruption, and how corruption has played a part in the development of the political sphere and in the development of the oil sector. And I think, you know, it's interesting to look at the region and understanding these things after reading the book. I think people will see the Kurds in a bit of a different light. While they are, you know, sort of more democratic and by political nature, there are these intense, you know, political rivalries and pay-to-play system in the oil sector. And, you know, everything's politicized there, even the media. And so once you take a step into that world, things become a bit more confusing and trying to understand the Kurds. And so what my book tried to do was to understand the complexities of the political sphere in Kurdistan through the lens of the oil sector and to try to, you know, follow the money a bit and to understand ways in which the oil money has funded these sort of political rivalries and how that spurred corruption.
And how has it done that? Kind of contrast for us a bit the situation before 2003, really, and after. You know, what really changed in terms of how oil deals were being struck in Iraqi Kurdistan? How did the actors change? How did the strategies change? Outsiders looking in, what changed for them? You describe a few characters in the book, sort of real chances sort of going into Iraqi Kurdistan after the US invasion, basically, almost like a gold rush, you know, just chancing their arm and seeing what they could get. You know, and some of them being rather disappointed, some, you know, being a bit more lucky. Just kind of paint a picture a bit, really, about the difference, really, I suppose, between dreams and reality.
So I think, you know, it's important to understand how the oil sector developed over time. So the first contracts weren't signed in the KRG until 2002. There were six contracts that were signed in 2002, but the vast majority of contracts were signed post-2003, post-invasion. But before even 2002, there was 5, 6, 7 years of conversations about oil, about, you know, completing seismic studies, trying to understand what was underneath the ground, trying to see who was interested, what kinds of players were interested. And it was very decentralized. So lots of different people were having these kinds of conversations, you know, political leaders in the PUK and the KDP and, you know, between the Barzani and the Talabani families. I mean, these were all conversations that people were having as far back as the 1990s. And as I said, it was very decentralized. There was no sort of understanding of how this would all come together later. And so it wasn't until 2002 that we saw, you know, the first contracts get handed out. And it was sort of a contract system that was very unclear. It was overseen in a sense by Baghdad, but definitely sort of administered and sort of run by the Kurds. And then after the toppling of Saddam, things changed completely. And as you said, there was this sort of rush to get into the country, thinking that the chaotic nature of war would perhaps make things a bit easier for international oil companies and consultants and lobbyists to sort of get their hands in this oil sector. And then we see a new character come into play, Ashley Harami, in 2005 and 6, who basically centralized everything. He came in and sort of made the terms of the contracts harsher. He renegotiated a lot of the contracts. He's known as a wheeler and dealer. He's a very good negotiator. But with that came a centralization of money and power. And that meant that the sort of chaotic, decentralized nature of the oil sector that we saw in the before, to, you know, in 2001 and 2, you know, that sort of changed completely. And so the power sort of ended up in the hands of just a few people, in particular Ashley Harami himself. He sort of, anyone who you talk to about the oil industry will tell you that the Minister of Natural Resources, Harami, is sort of, he has his hands in everything. He's, you know, involved in every negotiation. He's involved in the flow of money and setting the terms and speaking to delegations. And so, you know, a lot of people would argue that when that happened in 2005 and 2006, that things began to change and the corruption started to sort of come into fruition, in the sense that the KDP and the PUK started to get their hands on a lot of cash. And that's sort of the beginning of that story.
And Ashley Harami is still the Minister for Natural Resources, I gather?
He is, yes.
Okay. Because he emerges in the book as this very magnetic character throughout it, and he's really been right there at the center, really in the a kind of exemplar of a lot of the kind of corruption that's gone on, I suppose.
Yeah. Ashley's a sort of interesting character. He's incredibly rich. He's, you know, like a lot of these guys, a dual citizen between the UK and Iraq. He owns several mansions. He has just an incredible, incredible amount of wealth, as do many of these guys, these players who have their hands in the oil industry. And his second office, or his home office really, is in London. And so while he's the Minister of Natural Resources in the KRG, a lot of the deals are struck in London.
There's a good phrase in Turkish, it's something like, if you hold the honey pot, you're going to lick your fingers, which seems to apply to him very, very nicely.
Yes.
You talk in the book about a very important subject, really, about the kind of tension that emerged between Erbil and Baghdad, and it really did define politics, and a lot of the run-up to the referendum, the independence referendum last year, was wrapped up in this these negotiations to do with oil and natural resources. Basically, Erbil has this very complicated relationship. It's got this arrangement where apparently it should send the oil revenue to the central government in Baghdad in return for a 17% stake in the national budget. But in recent years, there's been serious complications, and those complications really center around this kind of budget dispute. And it's prompted really the KRG to start selling oil abroad, which is, of course, against the wishes of Baghdad, which says it's unconstitutional. And it's obviously complicated the relationship between the two, to put it mildly. Could you just try and kind of untangle this very tangled web for us?
Yeah, I mean, the deal between Erbil and Baghdad is a deal that's taken, you know, many different forms and has taken place over, you know, for more than a year now. And the last deal I saw on the table was basically, you know, a mishmash of, you know, the Kurds getting something like 12% of the budget while giving a portion of their revenue to Baghdad. Although I'm not sure if that deal still stands. But anyway, the deal itself between Erbil and Baghdad, I think, has been frustrating for everyone involved in the sense that it's really prevented the country from moving forward. I think that the Kurds have suffered more than Baghdad in the sense that, you know, the local economy in the KRG is in a dire situation. And the Kurds are in desperate need of an influx of cash. And I think Baghdad has a bit of the upper hand right now, especially since, you know, the referendum wasn't upheld. And, you know, we have elections coming up soon. I think the country's, you know, sort of just waiting to see the end result of this conversation between Erbil and Baghdad. The conversation is it's just about oil. And in a large sense, that tells a story about the country in general, that, you know, oil is the bloodline of the economy in Baghdad and in the KRG. And so anything that sort of disrupts that industry really sets the country back. And so hopefully they will come to an agreement over oil revenues. But for the Kurds, they've had a pretty tough 9 months. I mean, they, you know, the referendum, as I said, was not upheld. The sort of oil fields that they once controlled have been lost. The oil revenues seem to be slipping out of their hands. And so it's almost like all the work that the Kurds had done since 2013 and 14 to regain control of their economy has, you know, slipped out of their hands in a sense.
And related to that, you know, the role of Turkey and the Turkish government is very important on this point, because there was a deal struck between Ankara and Erbil back in 2012, in which basically Turkey and the Kurdish government, the KRG, constructed one new gas pipeline and two new oil pipelines, which went directly from the KRG to Turkey, connecting Kirkuk to Ceyhan in southern Turkey, near the border with Iraq. And I think the first shipments of crude flowed into those Turkish refineries in 2014. And obviously the central Iraqi government wasn't very happy about this, saying it was a violation of Iraqi sovereignty. And it really, it was one of the issues inflaming tensions between Ankara and Baghdad for a while. Could you just talk a bit about the Turkish role here in why this pipeline was significant, what Turkey did and how that affected the balance between the KRG and the central Iraqi government?
Yeah, sure. So the pipeline was a major breakthrough for the Kurds in the sense that they were, you know, able to bypass Baghdad in a way and send their oil out independently. And that was really the catalyst that allowed it to sort of not only gain control over their oil revenues and that sort of industry that exists in the KRG, but also to become on its way to becoming financially independent from Baghdad. And that was always, it's always been a Kurdish, like, you know, dream and hope. You know, if the Kurds do that, then independence wouldn't be that far off. And I think in a big way, that pipeline was gave the Kurds a new lifeline in a way, an economic lifeline anyway. But that's basically what started the tensions between Erbil and Baghdad. I mean, that's basically what set this whole negotiation process off. And ever since then, it's been hard for the Kurds to get back on track, at least politically. And it was that pipeline was sort of the start of it all. And it's what is, you know, the Kurds and Baghdad are still fighting over in a big sense, you know. And Turkey has been, you know, significant in other ways too. Turkish companies hold contracts in the KRG. For a while, the Kurds still owed a lot of money to those Turkish companies. And so the presence of Turkey in the KRG oil sector has been significant over the years.
And is it right that for a while there, while this dispute was going on between Erbil and Baghdad, Turkey was paying, or it was extending loans to the KRG to pay civil servants' wages? Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, those debts are central to the negotiations between Erbil and Baghdad because the KRG has to pay back those debts. And so that's been a point of contention. You know, the KRG wants, Baghdad wants control of the oil revenues, wants Baghdad to help pay those debts. And Baghdad, you know, has refused so far. So those Turkish debts are central to the conversation today.
And of course, the irony really is that the deal was crucial, as you mentioned there, in basically encouraging KRG independence from Baghdad, driving a wedge between the two. So it was kind of ironic, really, in the lead up to the independence referendum last year that took place in September. Turkey was obviously protesting very loudly, along with Baghdad and Iran, against this this independence referendum. But it really was kind of one of the midwives preparing the ground for this independence push.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I think we were all expecting Turkey to come out publicly in line with the U.S. and with Baghdad and with everyone else was falling that way. But you're right in the sense that on a smaller scale, that pipeline was sort of what drove the wedge between Erbil and Baghdad in the first place. So it was ironic in that sense. But I'm not sure. I don't think anyone was really expecting Turkey to have any other, you know, stance.
And what's the status of that pipeline now? Is the oil has been flowing even despite this dispute over the referendum last year? Is that right?
So Kurdish oil, this sector sort of, you know, at least in terms of production, dipped a little bit over the past 9 or 10 months or since the referendum, but it's been holding pretty steady. I mean, like I said, it's the production has dipped a bit and sort of waxed and waned over the past year or so, but for the most part, it's been sort of not disrupted.
And just thinking generally, I mean, these revelations are quite sweeping in the book. Nobody really comes out looking very good from it. I just wonder if how often you go back to Iraqi Kurdistan. I mean, can you go back safely? Is there anyone really put out by the reporting that you've done on this issue?
Yeah, I mean, I have not been back to Kurdistan since the book came out. I'd like to go back. I'm not sure I'd be welcome back. You know, I did, through my reporting process, received, you know, several threats and very formalized threats. And so I'm not sure if going back right now is the best idea. But I, more than anything, I'd like to get back to just talk to people returning home from, you know, internally displaced persons camps, understanding a bit about how they are going to support their families moving forward, what the economy will really look like after these elections. I mean, these are all questions I want answered and I'd like to see for myself. I'm not sure if going back right now is safest for me. But I think it's a really important story. And I know there are, you know, amazing journalists still there and have been there throughout all of this who are trying to answer these questions and are doing great work. So I look forward to, you know, whatever they sort of dispatch over the next few months.
That was Erin Banko. Many thanks to her. Remember to consider supporting Turkey Book Talk by joining as a member. All you have to do to become a member is pledge a minimum of $3 per episode via Patreon. Membership gives you access to transcripts in English and Turkish of every episode as it's published, as well as the entire Turkey Book Talk archive of over 60 conversations so far. You also get access to a special 30% discount on over 200 books on Turkey and Ottoman history published by IB Taurus. As a member, you'll be helping Turkey Book Talk keep the show on the road, developing further and providing a bigger platform for our guests and their work. And you can find links to the Patreon account in order to sign up via all the Turkey Book Talk websites. And many thanks to all current members, it's very much appreciated. Also, please do rate or review Turkey Book Talk on whatever podcast platform you listen on. You can follow via Twitter or like the Facebook page to stay fully updated with new episodes. And you can send any recommendations, feedback or abuse to williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. But until the next episode of Turkey Book Talk in a couple of weeks, thank you very much for listening.
show.